From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The story of one man's relentless pursuit of mind control through the CIA's secret program MKUltra might immediately be dismissed as conspiracy theory. But a man named Sidney Gottlieb did exist and was at the center of a story that defies the boundary between fiction and nonfiction. Gottlieb's oversight of a secret government mind control program is the focus of a new book by the acclaimed journalist and author Stephen Kinzer. Mr. Kinzer has written 9 books, including The True Flag, The Brothers, Overthrow, and All the Shah's Men. He's an award-winning foreign correspondent. He served as a New York Times bureau chief in Nicaragua, Germany, and Turkey. He's senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University and writes a world affairs column for the Boston Globe. And he now joins me to discuss his new book, Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA Search for Mind Control. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Good to be here.
So this book sounded so bizarre. The story is so bizarre. And, you know, we've heard a lot of folks over the years, especially in Pacifica radio circles where I run, who have a lot of conspiracy theories, some of which veer on the truth about the government's CIA program, MKUltra. Sidney Gottlieb, however, is not a name that comes up very much. Even if MKUltra is known, Gottlieb isn't. Tell us about this man, how he tried very hard to keep his identity secret, but was eventually outed, right? Who was he?
Sidney Gottlieb, I think, might have been the most powerful unknown American of the 20th century. Unless there was somebody else who was running secret prisons in which he was experimenting, sometimes fatally, on human beings across 3 continents and lived in complete invisibility and had what amounted to a license to kill from the U.S. government. As you mentioned in your opening, this is my 10th book. I've spent most of my career trying to find out what lies behind the facade of public diplomacy and public politics that we see. And I've found a number of things that may have surprised a number of people and some that surprised me. But this is the first time I've really been shocked. I have to say that I myself am still recovering from the shock of learning what is in this book. I cannot believe that this happened or that a person like Sidney Gottlieb ever existed. So he was a chemist who was hired by the CIA in 1951 to direct its most secret program, which was signified by the fact that the code name was MKUltra, and it was nothing more or less than the search for a potion or a technique or a drug that would allow the CIA to control people's minds.
So he was fascinated by this idea and convinced by the fact that somehow through a chemical substance, possibly made in, you know, by nature, the human mind could be controlled. Did he have any basis or any evidence to suggest that this was even possible?
This is a question that inevitably comes up when you start confronting Gottlieb's work, and I try to address it in the book. Yeah. So what made Gottlieb and his ultimate boss, Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA and that group at that time, believe that there was such a thing as a pill you could put into somebody's drink and then make them go out and kill someone and forget that they had done it or something like that? So I speculate on this. I think there were 2 groups of reasons. One is that in the hyper-conspiracy-oriented environment of the early Cold War, the CIA allowed itself to get carried away in a fantasy. It was actually a CIA propagandist who first came up with the word brainwashing. And he tried to persuade Americans that the communists were trying to brainwash us. But one of the victims of his propaganda campaign was the CIA itself. It began to fall for the idea of brainwashing. And there were a couple of episodes that fueled its fear. There was a show trial in Hungary at which the Roman Catholic prelate confessed to crimes he obviously hadn't committed, and he spoke in kind of a monotone and seemed to be glazed. Oh, this set off alarm bells at the CIA. It later turned out he had been coerced by very normal methods, but at the CIA was thought that he'd been brainwashed. Then there was the behavior of American prisoners of war who came home from Korea. Some of them had signed statements criticizing the United States or had even confessed to committing war crimes. We also assumed that the only way that could have happened was they'd been brainwashed. So that's one group of reasons. The hyperactive imaginations of the time overreacted to circumstances that were happening around them. But I think there might be a larger reason, which is the generations of stories and movies and novels all about the Svengali who hypnotizes somebody, and someone who can wake someone out of the dead, and various evil scientists who control monsters. I think that at a certain level, people began, at least people in the CIA, to conflate the fantasy of mind control that's always been interesting to writers of exotic fiction with reality. And they set off to do something that they had read about and seen in fiction and tried to create it in reality.
So Gottlieb was, I understand, given essentially carte blanche to do what he wanted, to design this program, that there were no real checks and balances, that he got to singularly control, single-handedly control and design this project that included experiments, that included actually testing some of these substances like LSD on unwitting Americans, right? I mean, how much control did he have and how little oversight did he have?
Gottlieb had almost no oversight. And I think part of the reason for this was that the people above him understood that he was doing some things that were very unpalatable and most unpleasant and included a lot of what would qualify as torture and including fatal torture. Therefore, with that instinctive knowledge, they didn't want to know any more about it. They approved of the program and its general outlines and then didn't want to hear the details. I think this is obedience to not only CIA culture, but the culture of secret services in general. Ignorance is an asset. You don't want to know too much. It puts you in a difficult position. So what was Gottlieb doing that was so horrific? He decided that before you could find a way to insert a new mind into somebody's brain, you first had to figure out a way to blast away the mind that was in there. He carried out intense, horrific experiments, both in prisons inside the United States and at secret CIA detention centers in Europe and in East Asia. These were aimed at finding ways in which a human psyche and a human body could be destroyed. And in a number of cases, he was successful. After 10 years of the most extreme experiments on human subjects that have ever been conducted by any officer or agency of the U.S. government, Gottlieb came to what amounted to two conclusions. First of all, yes, it is possible to destroy a person's mind with so much intense drugs, electroshock, and other forms of stress. But no, it is not possible to insert a new mind in that resulting void. So he left a trail of destroyed human beings, in some cases dead human beings, in a 10-year search for something that in the end, even he had to admit was a myth.
Who were some of his, famous, well-known subjects? You write in your book about figures like Allen Ginsberg and Timothy Leary, who became proponents of LSD as a path to enlightenment and who didn't realize that they were Gottlieb's experimental subjects.
In his search for the mind control drug, Gottlieb fixated on LSD. He was the first acid visionary. By his own account, he used LSD more than 200 times.
So he experimented on himself.
Exactly. And so he may even have conceived some of these experiments while he was under the influence. In 1953, Gottlieb persuaded the CIA to spend $240,000 to buy the entire world supply of LSD. He brought it over from the Swiss manufacturer to the United States, and he did two things with it. One was to carry out some horrific experiments, like locking prison inmates in a cell for 2.5 months and feeding them overdoses of LSD every day to see if it would destroy their mind, which of course it did. But he also had another, much more benign use for some of his LSD. He set up a couple of bogus medical foundations, and these foundations then announced to hospitals and clinics that there was interest in paying for research in which volunteers would come in and take a vial full of a psychoactive liquid so that their reactions could be monitored and recorded. So these clinics, not realizing that the money was coming from the CIA or that the data they were filing was actually being filed to the CIA, set up experiments all over the country. Among the very first people to participate in those experiments, to take LSD that came from Sidney Gottlieb, were Ken Kesey, the man who wrote To One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and set off the Kool-Aid acid tests. Allen Ginsberg, as you mentioned, the radical poet, went to Stanford University when he heard about these experiments and took his first LSD while listening to Tristan and Isolde on his headphones. The lyricist for The Grateful Dead, Robert Hunter, took his first LSD also at Stanford in a CIA-sponsored experiment and then brought the LSD home to the Grateful Dead. So it makes Gottlieb an unwitting godfather of the 60s counterculture. And the irony, of course, is that the drug Gottlieb hoped would give the CIA the power to control people's minds actually wound up fueling a generational rebellion that was aimed at destroying everything the CIA stands for.
So there's also this issue of, or an interesting part of the story, which is how he turned a very important, his base of operations was essentially Fort Detrick. Can you tell us a little bit about what he did there, what he stored there, how that became his very own sort of headquarters, mad scientist headquarters, if you will?
Fort Detrick in Maryland still exists, and it's still to this day the center of U.S. Army biological research. I went on a tour there as I was researching the book, and you can see sealed containers in which people work on very intensely controlled suits and climactic conditions. So this was the base where Gottlieb established his little corps of chemists. This is where he compounded all of his substances, and he was fascinated with poisons. I write in my book that he became the poisoner in chief. This is where I get the title of the book. He was the one who made the poisons that were intended to kill Fidel Castro. He's the one who made the poison kit to kill Patrice Lumumba, the prime minister of the Congo, and carried that kit from Washington to deliver it to the CIA station chief in the Congo. He's the guy who created the suicide pin that the U-2 pilots were carrying as they flew over the Soviet Union. All of these were compounded in his laboratory, well, centered in Fort Detrick. For example, this shellfish poison that he loved, it was what he used for his, what he called L pills, the lethal pills, particularly the pin that the U-2 pilots were given. This was something called saxitoxin. It was a shellfish poison, so strong that in the concentration he managed to dilute, 5,000 people could be killed with a single gram. And how did he get this poison? He got it by extracting minute amounts of toxin from thousands of Alaskan butter clams. That's the level of science that he was conducting at this extreme intersection of covert action and wild science.
Now, eventually, he became public. Well, actually, even before that, he retired. He retired at a youngish age in his 50s. First question, why did he retire? And second, how did his name finally become public? It was eventually him being brought before Congress, right, for his role in all of these things.
Gottlieb's protector during all of his years at the CIA was Richard Helms. And Richard Helms served as the director of Central Intelligence during Gottlieb's last period at the CIA. So when Richard Nixon fired Helms in 1973, that meant that Gottlieb's protector was gone. MKUltra wasn't so well seen anymore. Many of Gottlieb's friends and supporters had left the agency. So he retired. Very quietly, in one of those ceremonies where you get a medal and then you have to give it right back. Nobody still really understood what he had done. He was a secret even to many people inside the CIA. In fact, while I was writing this book, I met a former CIA director and told him, I'm writing the biography of Sidney Gottlieb, and he said, I never heard of him. And I believe him, I think he's right. So he dropped out of sight, and then Gottlieb did something that was an expression of another part of his persona that makes him all the more complicated. Here he was, perhaps the most prolific American torturer of his generation. Meanwhile, he was kind of a proto-hippie. He was very spiritual. He lived in an eco-cabin in the woods with no running water. He got up before dawn to milk his goats, and he meditated, and he studied Buddhism. When he retired from the CIA, he went on to become the true spiritual Sidney Gottlieb that he thought he always was. He and his wife sold their cabin. They got on a tramp freighter. They traveled around Asia and Africa trying to help poor, suffering people. And they were working at a hospital for people with leprosy in India when, in the summer of 1975, a message came from the CIA's General Counsel Office saying to Sidney Gottlieb, essentially, we have bad news for you. Somebody has figured out that you exist, and that somebody is the Church Committee, which is investigating the CIA. So Gottlieb had to come back to Washington, which must have been quite shocking to him since he lived his life in such total anonymity. He did have to testify before Congress, though he was allowed to do it in private rooms. The senators really never knew what to ask him. They didn't have any idea of most of what's in my book. So he got off very easy. He went on to become a tutor of children with speech defects, as he had one himself. He worked in a hospice. He was a community activist. But as I write at the end of my book, people who knew him in his last years say that he clearly seemed tormented. One guy who met him during that period told me he was racked with guilt. He was a broken man. He never spoke about MKUltra. A couple of times he was pushed to do so, but he refused. Nonetheless, anybody who believes in final judgment or karmic payback would have to be distressed to look back on a life and a career like that of Sidney Gottlieb.
Can you give us a few more details about the torture and death aspects of this story? When we talked about, Allen Ginsberg and Timothy Leary becoming LSD proponents, but that might be, and leaders in the sort of countercultural movement of the 60s, but that might be the sort of very, very, small upside, if you will, to this story. Let's explore that underbelly. What sort of experiments did he engage in that resulted, that were effectively torture and that actually resulted in death? Do we know the names of the victims?
No, when Gottlieb and Helms left office together, they agreed to destroy all records of MKUltra. And seven cases of records were destroyed over the stated objections of the CIA archivist. Nonetheless, we've been able to recreate a fair amount of what happened. But one thing we don't have is victims, names. We have a few who have come forward. But many of these people never even understood, I think, that something like this had happened to them. Gottlieb inside the United States used to like to cooperate with prison doctors and prison wardens because naturally they had a stock of volunteers, so to speak, who were reliant on them. So in one experiment at a prison in Kentucky, one of Gottlieb's prison doctors isolated 7 African-American inmates and fed them what were described as double, triple, and quadruple doses of LSD every day for 77 days.
Wow.
The idea was to find out if you could destroy a person's mind with that amount of LSD. And the answer, of course, is yes. But who were those people? Those names are gone. The protocols have all been destroyed. And it's quite within the realm of possibility, I think, that those people would have lived their whole lives, whatever lives they might have had, certainly devastated, without ever understanding what it was that they were fed and what had happened to them. Meanwhile, Gottlieb's experiments overseas were even worse because they often resulted in deaths, although there's no number available. Gottlieb worked at a network of CIA detention centers in East Asia and in Europe. I went out during the research for this book to find what I think was the CIA's first secret prison. It's in a lovely chalet in Germany that looks like it could be a bed and breakfast. The guy who owns it now took me down into the basement storerooms, and he told me it was in these cells that CIA doctors and chemists carried out torture experiments based on the experiments that Nazis had carried out in the concentration camps quite near here. And indeed, some of the doctors who advised the CIA interrogation teams on these extreme techniques were Nazis who had overseen experiments in concentration camps.
And wasn't Gottlieb Jewish?
This is one of the strangest aspects of it. So Gottlieb came from a Jewish family, and not only that, it was first generation. So his parents emigrated from Central Europe at the beginning of the 20th century. If they had not done that, if they had stayed in Europe, quite likely they could have been rounded up and Sydney could have been sent to a concentration camp where he would have been the victim of one of these gruesome so-called experiments. Nonetheless, he didn't seem to have any problem working shoulder to shoulder with the very Nazi doctors who carried out those experiments.
So finally, the other aspect of the story is that I imagine a tremendous amount of tax dollars went into these experiments. These are government experiments. This is something that there should have been oversight of. What is to stop a future Sidney Gottlieb from continuing this sort of, you know, maybe it won't be mind control this time. It might be some other sort of chemical warfare or biological warfare. And indeed, these things may be happening right now that we don't have any information about.
Delving into the story of MKUltra and Sidney Gottlieb and realizing how much he was able to do with as little supervision definitely does raise these questions. How deep does the secret sphere go? As you said, you don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, but his story definitely is an indication that much goes on behind that facade of public politics and public diplomacy that we see. You have to ask yourself, are there other people like Gottlieb out there now, particularly given the fact that technical capacities are now so much greater? The ability to supervise is even less now than it was then. So his story definitely raises some larger questions. And it does show you that when patriotism takes over as a transcendent value, as I think it did for Gottlieb, you begin to feel that your country is in a situation of such great threat that you have to put aside temporarily the rules of conduct and ethics and morality that you normally abide by. And what I think he did, and the danger for us today, is that he lost sight of this question: is there a limit to the amount of evil that you can carry out in what you think is a good cause before the evil starts to outweigh the good?
Stephen, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Can't wait to see what your next book is going to be about. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
My guest has been Stephen Kinzer, the author of 10 books, including Overthrow and All the Shah's Men, and his latest book that we've just been discussing, Poisoner-in-Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA's Search for Mind Control. He's also a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.